No reindeer. You'll go down in history.
Hello and welcome to the Skeleton Factory Podcast,
episode 75.
This is Adam coming to you from Austin, Texas, and we are at the tail end of 2023. I hope everybody had a wonderful Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa. This episode is going to be a kind of a catch-up episode from the year 2023. So all these movies I'm going to talk about are all new films from this year, and a lot of them I saw in theaters, and I just wanted to skim over them and kind of give my thoughts on them. Okay, well, we got a bunch of movies, so let's jump right into let's see. Warm Blood. The movie Warm Blood from... It's actually a 2022 film, but it's been going around the country in like every film festival. And then finally, it just got actually a physical media release. And I got the DVD of it. Pre-ordered it. And I was really interested in watching this movie because it takes place near where I grew up in California, in a town called Modesto. I'm from a town that's right next to Modesto called Manteca, and that's next to Stockton, and that's the Central Valley. That's the Central Valley of Northern California, and it's kind of a weird place. Warm Blood. Okay, I'm just going to say it's a 2023 film, because really that's when you can actually see the damn thing. It's directed by a guy named Rick Charnorsky. And it's the story of a runaway high school girl named Red, played by Haley Isaacson. This is her first time acting in a movie ever. This is her first time acting role, and it's based on a diary, her actual diary. And basically, the character is about her. So she basically is playing herself in this film. And the movie takes place in the 1980s, and it's not, it's clearly not the 1980s, though. You know, there's definitely things in the movie that, you know, didn't exist in the 1980s. Like, you can tell that there's certain cars that weren't around in the 80s. There's a scene where she goes to a liquor store, and just like the TV security monitors in there are clearly like little cheap flat screens that probably didn't come out until the late 90s, early 2000s. Like, there's just stuff like that that's not like, I don't think it's a nitpick. It's like things that are really obvious. You know, there's little interviews kind of spliced into like the movie from the point of view of like a local TV station, and they're interviewing kind of basically tweakers from Modesto, you know, who I'm sure have fascinating stories to tell. But, you know, there's like one guy in particular, he's wearing like Bluetooth headphones around his neck. You know, those that just didn't exist in the 80s. So there's things like that that kind of took me out of the movie. Because here's the thing is the movie. Okay, the movie, I don't know why it even is taking place in the 80s at all, because Haley Isaacson, she's not, you know, like a 40 or 50 year old woman or something. She's like a young person. And this movie's based on her actual diary. So I don't understand why this doesn't take place now. You know, it just seems like it would be easier to shoot if it was a story that takes place now. But for some reason, it takes place in the 80s. And it's, Yeah, I don't know why that decision was made, but Red returns to her hometown of Modesto. And she's basically a runaway. She was out in L.A. She steals some dude's car that she was shacking up with and returns to Modesto to find her father. Okay. That's basically the whole kind of point of the movie, I guess. It's sort of the through line, sort of. But but then you get things like, you get scenes where she's like cutting herself and does meth with the zombie people of the Central Valley of Northern California. And she's just kind of partying. And you can kind of see how gross and disgusting that part of the country is. And I don't know. I don't know if it's because I'm so close to it, because I just grew up near places like that where I don't romanticize it. You know, I'm not nostalgic for that kind of I don't know, that sort of disgusting low class tweaker existence that still exists to this day, but it was like really, really a thing in the 80s and especially the 90s when I was a teenager. It was, I don't know. It's like, I'm not saying that you can't extrapolate an interesting story from that environment. I just, I don't know. It's like, I figure if you're going to do something like that, something like, I don't know, something like Gummo, it's just like lean into the craziness, you know, like lean into the craziness and then try to squeeze a story in there somewhere, which I feel like it was, the movie was kind of did to some extent, but so let me tell you a story. I want to tell you a story about my best friend in high school. It's this guy named Josh, who was basically the character of Red in a lot of ways. Okay. He was a runaway who did a lot of meth, and he lived in the closet of my childhood bedroom. Okay. So after school, Josh would come over after my parents went to bed, and he would sneak in through the window, and he would crash in my closet, and you know, until he I went to school one day and Josh didn't, he just slept in and my stepdad came into my room and found Josh sleeping in my closet and woke him up and was like, what the hell's going on around here? And my parents basically had this talk with him when I was at school. They were basically like, how long have you been sneaking into our house at night and crashing here? And, you know, it was like months, like it was a while. And my stepdad and my mom talked to Josh, and he wasn't a bad person, you know. He was a pretty decent guy, and he was pretty loyal to people, and he was actually very well mannered, but he liked to party, you know. He was a child of bad influence. Okay, like he ran away from home because his parents were they were basically tweakers who lived in a van behind an AMPM. Okay. And they would like lead an extension cord from their van to like the back of this like warehouse that was behind the AMPM. And you know, they lead an extension cord into the van. The van would have like one of those like box window air conditioner units, like stuffed into the back of the van, and a TV in there. And the place, it was just like a hoarder van, and it smelled bad. And I mean, not the best parents. Okay, so Josh very much took it upon himself to stay away from his parents as much as he could, but I don't know, we were friends, so I was always like, oh, well, you know, you can come crash at my place and stuff. And basically my parents made a deal with him where they were like, okay, you can live in our house and everything, but you have to finish school and you have to have a job. Okay. And that's pretty much it. Because that was the deal my parents had with me and my older brother. You know, if you're going to be in high school, you have to get decent grades and you have to work. So, but I don't know. He's just, it's just like I don't know if it's just my particular generation in particular. Like everyone's parents were divorced and everyone was very latchkey. Kids in a lot of ways, and everyone just wanted to party, you know. So you know, it's, I don't know, like that, which I mean, it did lead to a lot of bad things, obviously. People getting arrested, people getting in car wrecks, people getting in fights, people getting sent to jail, people overdosing, like all that horrible stuff. But that's kind of what this movie is like. It's kind of like revisiting my childhood in a way, and you know, and I can kind of relate to the Red character, like my friend Josh and I, we both had sort of strained to non-existent relationships with our fathers, and I don't know, this movie was kind of like revisiting my childhood, like my hometown. And you know, there's like a part of you that you don't ever want to go back to your hometown because you kind of feel like a failure. You know, that's kind of what this movie feels like, you know. And it's not a bad movie, but you know, it's not cohesive enough of a story for me. You know, it's the director, I think, had a lot of opportunities to interview kind of real grimy fucking people, but and then try to put those interviews together with the story with the Red character, kind of, you know, you hear a lot of kind of narration where she's kind of reading out of her diary. She, you know, talks about her mother putting her through therapy and, you know, her relationships with her shitty friends growing up. And, you know, there is a through line. There is like a story there, but I don't know. This movie's more of like a kind of a, this weird, like a, this weird oddity, you know, this like morbid curiosity type of movie where I just wanted to see, like, how do people portray the Central Valley in a movie? And I guess I expected more out of it. And like I said, it's not a bad movie. I would recommend, I'd give it a soft recommendation. Like, I think it's worth watching at least once, because, you know, not everyone kind of grew up in those types of places. So it's kind of interesting to see how other types of people grew up and what type of places these, you know, like what makes these types of kind of people who are sort of self-destructive and, you know what I mean? It's a nature and nurture thing working together to kind of create these sort of like hopeless, self-destructive people. And it's kind of that sort of story. There's like almost like there's a feeling of like hopelessness in this movie. So it's like things like that I respect in a movie, because if you can capture it for real and you can sort of observe it from an outside perspective, it's like, wow, that's That's really rough. That's how people live, huh? That's kind of sad. And you feel for her because she's like a teenager. You know what I mean? She's not like a grown up. So, and you know, it's, I feel for kids who kind of didn't really have a chance to grow up normal. And that, you know, that's kind of a lot of the people I grew up with. You know, they didn't really have a chance to grow up normal at all. So they're not normal. And that kind of leads to them being really, really interesting and really fucked up simultaneously. So, I mean, this movie's fine. You know, I kind of built it up in my head. Like, I've been wanting to watch it for so long. And now that I've seen it, I think it's okay. It's definitely not my favorite movie of this year, but like, I would rather watch a double feature of like Gummo and the Year Between, which came out last year, which is a really good comedy. And I've been really kind of hyping up that movie. But yeah, it's called the Year Between. That's a really good movie. And it's just kind of like that in a double feature with Gummo. That would be a really good movie night for you and your friends. But again, I give Warm Blood a kind of a soft recommendation. If you come across it, you know, watch it. I wouldn't say go out of your way to buy it or anything like that, but you can rent it. It's fine. What else I watched lately? Oh my god, I streamed the movie Divinity. I came across Divinity on Instagram. I saw a trailer for it, and visually I thought it looked kind of cool. It was sort of this shot kind of in black and white, almost had like this kind of cyberpunk feel to it. And I like cyberpunk stuff, so I was like, okay. So let's get into Divinity. Steven Soderbergh presents Divinity. Written and directed by Eddie Alcazar. And I would say be cautious of any director lending their name to a film. I'm not saying don't watch it. I'm just saying be cautious when some director's like, I'm going to put my name on something and then have other people direct it, because you may be disappointed in that the thing with their name on it is not like work that they have done. Like, do you remember the made-for-TV version of The Shining? Remember how it kind of sucked? Well, imagine the same thing, but with like Blade Runner. Imagine Blade Runner with a $10 million budget in 2023 dollars, okay? That's basically this movie, which it sounds like it's giving it too much credit, but it is giving it too much credit. this movie is no Blade Runner. Let me just get that out of the way. So basically, Divinity, two guys break into the mansion of a wealthy scientist played by Stephen Dorff. You know, Deacon Frost from Blade. And he Stephen Dorff owns a company that produces Divinity, a sort of magical elixir that is the literal fountain of youth. Okay. The little bottle, the little eyedropper, and you give yourself a couple drops in this, and it basically stops your body from aging and like reverses aging. So, and like Stephen Dorff, basically, Divinity's been around a long time. Okay, they kind of set up that his dad invented Divinity, and he also became a scientist like his dad, and is now the guy who studies and manufactures, you know, and Divinity. And so, yeah, two guys break into Stephen Dorff's house, and these two home invaders take Stephen Dorff hostage, torture him by tying him to a chair and giving him an IV of pure, uncut divinity. Okay, straight into his vein. And this turns him into this, like, muscle-bound monster. Like, he looks like a street shark. Remember Street Sharks? The animated cartoon about sharks with human bodies fighting crime. That's what he ends up looking like. And Stephen Dorff's basically like, you can't give somebody straight divinity. You have to cut it. And then, you know, you have to basically dilute it before you put it in your body. And these guys just tie him to a chair and just put an IV of pure divinity in his body. And he's basically like, this is going to kill me. And the guys are like, it's not going to kill you. But at the same time, you're like, why are they doing that? So he ends up becoming, like, the more divinity he gets, his body starts getting, like, super muscular, like the Incredible Hulk or something. And along the way, a high-end call girl stops by the mansion. And instead of helping Stephen Dorff escape, she has a threesome with the two brothers who broke into the house and ends up, like, joining them in their mission to do whatever it is that they're doing. We don't know what they want. We don't know what they want. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know who they work for. But this, like, hooker stops by the house, who was supposed to come see Stephen Dorff, and mistakes these two brothers as the, you know, the guy who, whoever called for the sex call, and then has sex with them. And then, you know, it's revealed that Stephen Dorff is being held hostage, and these two guys are holding him hostage, and she just, like, joins them. Okay. And what else? We get a cameo by internet fitness influencer Mike O'Hearn. Who I know Mike O'Hearn. I've seen him around on Instagram and stuff, and he's a very underused character. Okay, Mike O'Hearn is like, he's like a Greek god. Okay, he's a very, very handsome man. He's very jacked. He's like you know, he looks the part, and he plays Stephen Dorff's brother. So when he finds out that his brother's being tied to a chair and tortured in his mansion, he goes to save his brother. And of course, I mean, Mike O'Hearn is filled with divinity. Like, he knows he has to save his brother. One, because it's his brother. Two, is because his brother's, like, the only guy who knows how to make divinity. So he goes to the house to try to save him, and he's, like, easily defeated by these two puny brothers who are supposed to be the good guys, I guess. It's not really clear. Mike O'Hearn is a giant, imposing man, and these two brothers are like these little short dudes who aren't particularly they don't have an impressive build. They don't seem to be particularly strong or skilled at fighting in any way, but somehow these two guys just easily kick Mike O'Hearn's ass and kill him. They beat him to death with their bare hands. Okay, and once Stephen Dorff becomes a jacked mutant with superhero strength, okay, because he's just been fed divinity straight into his bloodstream. Okay, so which at this point they got someone else to play his character. They get a guy who's even bigger than Mike O'Hearn, strapped to a chair with like an elephant man head. Okay. The movie stops and immediately turns into like a stop motion animated movie. And the brothers fight Stephen Dorff in a sort of animated style, right? And they easily defeat him in a very, like, just anticlimactic, not interesting fight. And that's the end. That's divinity. And there's a, I think there's a real missed opportunity to tell an original sci-fi action story here. Or have a trippy sci-fi movie that's weird for the sake of being weird. That's kind of what they, like, they basically set up, like, ooh, we can have an original sci-fi action movie. Cool. But they opted for, like, a movie that's weird for the sake of just being weird and sort of hanging a sort of cobbled together science fiction cyberpunk story onto it and then making everything kind of visually, I don't know, weird and experimental and avant-garde and, like, and it's like, why? It's like they had a lot of good pieces, but none of the pieces connected very well. And meanwhile, the Divinity movie Instagram, the Divinity movie Instagram page does the classic bait and switch. There's a post of a screenshot from Dread Central, and the title of the article from Dread Central is a quote from Stephen Dorff. That's the title of the article, right? And it says, in reference to Divinity, the movie, it's like Elephant Man meets A Clockwork Orange. That's a quote from Stephen Dorff. So even Dread Central is passing the buck on Divinity. Okay? They could have just came up with their own title. Instead, they were like, let's have Stephen Dorff shoot himself and everybody involved with this movie in the foot, because the movie's really not that good. Okay, it's not like The Elephant Man, except that it's in black and white. You could have said anything. He's like, you could have said it's like, I don't know, The Maltese Falcon. Or the first half of The Wizard of Oz. He could have said anything that was black and white. He could have said it's like Sin City meets A Clockwork Orange. And it's not like either one of those things. The reason why earlier I made a reference to, like, Blade Runner is because in Blade Runner, there is this super genius man who owns this huge company. He's very, very rich and wealthy. And he has figured out a way to create, in a sense, immortality, making replicants, making artificial people. And he figured out how to install memories and emotions into these replicants to the point where the replicants don't even know that they're artificial. They think they're actual people. Okay? And then he has his own creations, like in Blade Runner. Rutger Hauer's character comes to the Tyrell pyramid. He manages to sneak his way in, and he ends up, you know, when Tyrell can't give him more life, he kills him. He kills his creator, his father, his god. Okay? And Harrison Ford is tasked with killing replicants. That's his job. That's what a Blade Runner does. And then, you know, in the process, he realizes that replicants have the ability to be as human as humans, in that just executing them on sight is wrong, in a sense. Okay, like, just because the law says we need to kill these people over here, just because it's just like that's inherently wrong. Okay, that's, to me, that's, Divinity is like Blade Runner in that sense, in that the two twin brothers, but they're not even really twins. They're these two little brother guys break into the guy's mansion and they basically torture him to death. But it's like they didn't even want anything from him. You know, Stephen Dorff tries to offer them money. Like, I'll give you money if you untie me and go away. They were like, we don't want your money. They don't even describe what it is that they want, even in the form of exposition, just talking to each other. We don't know what they want. And they end up creating the monster that they have to fight at the end for no reason. It's like, if they wanted Stephen Dorff dead, they could have just broken into his house and just killed him. But they wanted to torture him to death, which doesn't make them the best protagonist, because protagonists don't usually torture people to death. Okay. Yeah. I don't know where Stephen Dorff makes the connection that this movie is anything like Elephant Man or A Clockwork Orange. With that being said, I do not recommend Divinity. I do not recommend it at all. Instead, because I'm not just going to give it a no recommendation and just leave you hanging. Instead of watching Divinity, you can spend your time watching, watch Strange Days. Watch Strange Days. Watch RoboCop 2, okay? And watch Beyond the Black Rainbow. Watch those three movies. It's a better use of your time than watching Divinity. And I feel bad for Mike O'Hearn. That guy looks like a superhero. You know, with all the superhero shit going on, you know, the past couple decades. And all of these, like, wrestler properties. Like, why wasn't Mike O'Hearn in the Iron Claw or something? Anyways, that was Divinity. What else did I see? I went to the theaters. Went to the theater and I watched the film Priscilla. Priscilla, directed by Sofia Coppola. And it's based on a memoir written by Priscilla Presley, who was also the executive producer of this film. So that right off the bat, I had a good feeling about this movie. Sofia Coppola, pretty competent director. It's based on a book written by Priscilla Presley, and she's the executive producer. And a lot of this movie takes place at Graceland, you know, where Elvis lives. And I'm pretty sure a lot of this movie was shot at Graceland. I'm not 100% sure of that, but it looks like it probably was shot at Graceland. So that's pretty impressive. And how else are you going to get that type of access? You know, it's good to have Priscilla Presley on your side, I guess. So, I liked Priscilla. I liked Priscilla, just like right off the bat. I think I would give it, I would recommend it. You know, I'd recommend this movie. I don't think it's like the most rewatchable film, so I'll give it a slightly stronger than a soft recommendation. I recommend it more than, say, Warm Blood. Okay. But, let's see, the actress that played Priscilla Presley, Callie Spaley, I think that's how her name is pronounced. Let me double check that. Let me see. Kylie Spaney. I think I'm saying that right. So, Kylie Spaley plays Priscilla Presley from the ages of 14 to 27. That's pretty impressive. Okay. It shows Elvis. This is post Jailhouse Rock. He joins the army. He gets sent overseas. And while he's there, he meets Priscilla Presley. And she's 14. Okay. And then we see him sort of, they meet. He starts kind of courting her. And the way the story goes is it's very, Elvis is, the term is called grooming nowadays, but it doesn't seem like Elvis was making any kind of moves on Priscilla until she was like an adult kind of thing. But we basically see their relationship from when they first met when she was 14 all the way to them getting engaged, her moving in, back to the States, moving to Graceland, marrying Elvis, having kids, all the way up until their relationship falling apart. That's, I mean, it's, this movie's their entire timeline of them being married. And I like it a lot. It's the movie comes off a lot like, it's like an indie film. You know, I was expecting a big, ridiculous film with a lot of Elvis on stage type of stuff. A lot of, you know, a lot of CG maybe. I don't know. And but there was really none of that. You know, like when they're like, oh, hey, we're going to go out to Vegas. And then it just, we cut to stock footage of Vegas in the 60s. Okay, they just pulled up some old footage and they're like, oh, we're going off to Vegas. And they just show some old footage of Vegas instead of like recreating it or something. I was like, oh, that's very simple and clever. But yeah, we a lot of Priscilla's relationship with Elvis from her perspective was Elvis was gone a lot of the time. He was off being Elvis. He was off being Elvis, and then he was sort of building back up to his like comeback. So, what was it? The 68 comeback special. That was the Elvis in the black leather outfit, the like black leather jumpsuit, that performance. That was like his big comeback thing, which is also in the movie. And, but a lot of the time Elvis was off making, Elvis made a fucking breathtaking amount of movies in his short life, and most of them are unwatchable, but he really tried to make a push to be a real actor, you know. But at the while he was out doing that, his wife is just sitting at home, you know, reading tabloid magazines and wondering if he's out having affairs with you know, Hollywood starlets. You know, so you really feel her isolation and her loneliness, you know, being the wife of Elvis. And when he is around, you really see his kind of control that he must have over everything. Like his world, the world of Graceland. And, you know, Elvis had his family living with him, and Elvis had his entourage, the Memphis Mafia. You know, he had all these people around him, and it was like he was sort of in charge of most, pretty much everyone's behavior for the most part. And then like Elvis's dad was in charge of like finances. And so he had like a, this, and then of course there was the Colonel who we, I don't think was even in the movie. We just see Elvis on the phone talking to the Colonel. That's the extent of we see of Colonel Parker. But I think the movie was very smart how they shot everything in the most simplistic way, but made the most impact. You know, we didn't need everything spelled out for us. You know, like if you see a, if there's a wife who's jealous that her famous husband might be screwing around, you know, behind her back, like this movie's really good at sort of doing the most minimalist of approaches. You know, Priscilla be reading some tabloids like, oh, Elvis and Anne Margaret are getting hot and heavy on the set of blah, 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 blah. And it's just Priscilla's, it's like camera looking at that headline and then Priscilla's face. And you're just like, ooh, It's like, that's not good. And then when Elvis finally comes home, she's just like, why do I read all this stuff in the newspapers? And Elvis is just like, that's just the tabloids. They're just stirring up shit. That's just the tabloids. It doesn't mean anything. You know, it's probably not even true. You know, it's, so you see their, as much as they love each other, you see them clashing as a married couple. And she had to put up with a lot, but you could tell that the two of them really loved each other the whole time, but it just didn't work out, which is, you know, that happens. It's very relatable. Sofia Coppola made a very relatable, beautiful movie, and I thought it was really good. I did hear that Elvis's daughter, Lisa Marie Presley, hated the script. You know, I'm sure she gets to approve scripts probably to some extent. And apparently she hated the script. And so Lisa Marie Presley, she died this year. Yeah, she died in January, the beginning of 2023. Okay. Sofia Coppola had her killed. And then, you know, so that Sofia Coppola can get her movie made. No, that's not true. I just made that up. But rest in peace, Lisa Marie Presley. It's very sad. She didn't get to see this movie actually come out. And I mean, she didn't really like the script. So I don't know if she would have liked the movie. But from what I've read, the way the movie portrays Elvis, she just doesn't believe that that's accurate. Like this isn't who my dad was, which was a guy who was very famous, very busy all the time, definitely screwing around on his wife, definitely had a drug problem, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's like, isn't that anytime you see a story about Elvis, those are like the main points. And I don't know why she's resisting that. It sounds like she's resisting it in a way where she's saying that's not true. It'd be one thing if someone was like, yeah, my dad was all those things, but I don't like people smearing his name in movies. Okay. It hurts to see people point out my father's, you know, faults, you know, especially way after the fact, now that he's dead and everything. But it's like, I'm pretty sure the whole, like, Elvis, you know, Elvis had a drug problem. Elvis had an infidelity problem, you know, and Elvis probably, you know, had some anger issues. I feel I'm not part of the Presley family, but I feel like the movie's accurate. But with all due respect to Lisa Marie Presley, I think her mom would probably know who Elvis was a little better than she would. But Priscilla, go check it out. It's a very well-made movie. It's a very understated movie. It's not a big bombastic shit show like the Elvis movie that came out. It's very people in rooms talking kind of thing, you know? It's a very minimalist approach to an Elvis story. And it's not even really about Elvis. Elvis is like a side character, which I love that. And they keep Elvis as a side character. Like, he is second fiddle. It's like, this is a Priscilla Presley movie. And I think they get that message across loud and clear. So, yeah, Priscilla, go check it out. It's a fine film. It's a good date night film. I saw it with my wife. Ooh, let's jump into... Actually, I'm going to jump into some of my coffee real quick. Let's jump into another film I saw in theaters. Dream Scenario. Also from this year, 2023. I was very stoked for Dream Scenario. Okay, we're living in this time where Nicolas Cage, the amount of work he's been putting out is insane. Okay, this guy averages, you know, what? 4, 5, 6 movies a year, something crazy like that, of varying qualities. You know, this is one of the better quality Nicolas Cage movies, you know, of recent years. Dream Scenario, directed by Christopher Borgli, who I've already been on the Borgli train for quite some time. His two previous films, Sick of Myself from 2022, and a movie called Drib, D-R-I-B, Drib from 2017. Both those movies I covered in episode 62 of Skeleton Factory. And just great, great movies. Really interesting. God damn it. I'm going to have to edit that out. My friend John tried to call me just now, but I'm recording an episode. Sorry, John. All right. Where was I? Ah, yes. So I saw Sick of Myself last year in 2022. I saw a trailer for it, and I could tell immediately I was going to really like this movie. So I saw Sick of Myself, completely obsessed with it, and then I went back and watched his film before that, Drib. So when I heard that Christopher Borgli is making a film in the States with American actors speaking English, I was like, this is going to be amazing. This is going to be amazing. Christopher Borgli's movies have some very specific type of similarities. I don't want to say so much a formula, but they have similarities, okay? One is the main character is always a seemingly normal person, okay? The main character is never a rock star or a doctor or something like that. It's always just a regular person with a regular job, okay? And this very normal character gains some minor celebrity of some kind. And it's always like an unconventional, niche, obscure type of celebrity. And after experiencing some minor celebrity, the character will make attempts to get more famous, but it ends up just blowing up in their face as a result. Okay, that is in every Christopher Borgli film, and I think it's a really good kind of starting point. Because you can really kind of go anywhere, which is a huge thing in his movies. Okay, so also every movie does a very good job of being one kind of film up to a point, then turning on a dime into something else. Right when you think you can kind of predict what's going to happen next, or you can kind of predict what's going to happen at the end, he changes course on you. So he's very unpredictable, but the unpredictability is very engaging. It's not like the movie was one way and now it's doing something else and you're like lost. Like, you're definitely like, ooh, we made a little right turn here somewhere and now we're on another road and I'm totally down for the ride kind of thing. Also, every location in all his movies must be sort of unique and nice, but yet like familiar. Okay. A lot of interiors of houses, offices, schools, hallways, theaters, places you know, but they look cool. Like, nothing ever looks shitty. Everything always looks, especially in his last two films, this one and Sick of Myself, Drib kind of has that going on too. But it feels very, very, it feels very contemporary. But Sick of Myself has, it has, I don't know, it has probably a little bit more visual charm than Drib. And Dream Scenario, just every set is, that's one thing. I was just like looking at, like Nicolas Cage's house and the school that where his character works at. And they go, there's a scene where they go to a theater and stuff. And I'm like, I wonder how much of all that was real. Cause it all looks like real actual locations and stuff. And Christopher Borgley is he's very cognizant of, your viewing experience. You know, you need to kind of have stuff that's nice to look at, but without looking too movie-like. It can't look overly cinematic in a way where it's like, it takes you out of the film. Like, you feel like, oh, this looks like a real place, and it looks like it's a nice real place. You know, it doesn't feel like, oh, this is clearly a fake house, or it's, you know, this room is just a set, and it just feels like I'm in a movie right now. There's a lot of realism to his movies. Nicolas Cage, okay, he plays a sort of meek, mild-mannered college professor. You know, sort of regular guy who begins appearing in the dreams of an untold number of people all over the world. Okay. Like, he runs into one of his exes. She's like, you know what's weird? I had a dream about you recently. And then, like, his family's like, you know what? You were in my dream. And then, like, students in his class, like, every one of his students, he appears in their dream. And initially, he's just in the dream. He's not doing anything. He's just passing through. And so we get a lot of cool kind of flashbacks, montage type of stuff of people in their dreams. And there was one where I think it was one of his students is like, I had a dream last night, you were in my dream. And she's like sitting, she's like on top of like a table, and there's two alligators coming towards her in this room. Okay, this is like her dream. And Nicolas Cage just kind of walks past the room and just kind of looks at her and then just walks away. He doesn't help her or anything. He doesn't interfere in the dream in any way. He just appears and then he's gone. Okay, and this becomes a phenomena that's all over the world at some point. So this phenomena hits the internet at some point, and then just from there goes completely viral. Millions, maybe billions of people were sharing their experiences about this man whom they've never met, just strolling through their dreams. And Nicolas Cage doesn't know why this is happening. You know, he's not doing anything. He doesn't know why this is happening. He doesn't know how this is happening, but it seems to had gotten to the point where he actually is kind of a minor celebrity because of it. But when at some point people's dreams start becoming nightmares, Nicolas Cage's appearance in people's dreams, it was kind of go from very innocuous to full blown. People are like being attacked by Nicolas Cage in their dreams, and they're so terrified and threatened by it that they actually feel like he is somehow doing something to them, and he basically gets canceled because of it. Like, an entire campaign to cancel Nicolas Cage because he is appearing in people's nightmares and doing horrific things to him. Again, something he has no control of, and he has no answer to why this is happening. But he's very empathetic. You know, he doesn't want to harm anybody, but people are... He basically becomes public enemy number one. And even though he has no control over this phenomenon, it doesn't take long for the kooks. The mentality of people whose hobbies consist of just being easily offended and playing who can be the loudest victim. Okay. Those people come out of the woodwork. Okay. And those are like the nastiest detractors to Nicolas Cage, you know, and squeaky wheel gets the grease. So eventually these people are like, this man is evil. He's trouble. He's somehow getting inside people's dreams and doing horrible things to them on purpose. And he knows he's doing it on purpose. And we have to cancel this man, and we have to, you know, basically fuck up his life in order to get even or bring justice to the world or whatever it is these people think they're doing. You know, it's like anyone else who gets canceled, you know. It gets vicious very quickly. And it works. It works. And because it works, you know, the pile on begins. He's fired from his tenured professor job. His wife leaves him and is ridiculed and even at one point violently attacked. Okay, so his life basically just is ruined because of this phenomenon. But it's Dream Scenario succeeds as a really good sort of comedic satire of internet cancel culture and people latching on to things that really they have no way of. People want to be part of something. And a lot of the times the people who want to be part of something have no way of actually making any real change. Like, what was it? Coney 2012? Remember Coney 2012? There was some warlord in Uganda who was basically this torturous dictator guy. And these people wanted to get together and stop him. They got like Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt involved. They were going to try to like lure Coney out of the jungle and then capture him and kill him, I guess. I don't know. Does anyone know what the fuck I'm talking about? Coney 2012. Yeah. It's like things like that. You know, a black square on your Instagram. You know, a Ukraine flag, a French flag on your social media profile. It's like, I think it's very, very clear and very obvious that most people who back those sorts of things really aren't helping in any way. And also, what if you're wrong? What if you pile on to somebody who's being canceled for whatever reason and you're wrong? What then? Nothing happens. You just, I guess you have one or two options. You can rather just have like the sort of cognitive dissonance. That's the term, right? Where you know that you were wrong about this thing, but you just refuse to acknowledge it. So you just keep being like, oh no, we have to stop Joseph Kony. Or, you know, maybe you realize that you were backing the wrong horse or the wrong organization, or activist group. Maybe they weren't exactly who they said they were, or were doing what they said they were going to do, or helping, or, you know, whatever. And a lot of time it boils down to money. There's groups that'll just sap money from, you know, donations, governments, corporations, and, you know, they don't use that money to fix the thing that their whole organization is based around fixing, you know? But when it comes down to, like, a single individual, like Nicolas Cage's character in Dream Scenario, everyone just goes after this one guy, you know, and just ruin the fucking guy's life. And he literally does not do a thing wrong. You know, it's the movie succeeds in kind of shining a light on, I don't know, the past decade and a half of cancel culture, but while still being really funny and having a the sort of coherence and having the surreal flavor that Christopher Borgli kind of specializes in. Okay. That's part of him sort of like, you know, leading you down a path of like, here's these characters, here's what's going on with them. And then there's like the sort of inciting incident. And then you kind of see the fallout from that. But right when you think like, okay, the logical conclusion is this, he's like, no, we're going to switch gears and go this way. And that movie does that. And it goes down a path you would never think was going to happen. But it's still very enjoyable. It's not confusing. It's not weird for the sake of being weird, like the movie Divinity. It's a very coherent film. But it's like, it does play around with like, let's get a little weird here and there. Let's insert different genres. Well, you know, different genres can kind of slide in and out freely in this film, and it works. It sort of adds to the fun of the movie. And the movie, I think the movie is fun. You know, it's kind of tragic in a way, but it's still, you know, it's still funny, and it's still an interesting story. And I liked it a lot. I would rewatch Dream Scenario, and I recommend Dream Scenario. Go check it out. It's streaming right now. I don't think it's in theaters anymore, but if you get a chance, watch Dream Scenario. It's much more fun than watching The Ball Drop in New York City on New Year's. You can be watching Dream Scenario high on mushrooms while doing whippets with your family. Anyways, let's jump into the next movie, which was oh my God. I went into this next movie completely cold. I didn't know a thing about it. And that is the movie Saltburn. Saltburn. 2023 film directed by Emerald Fennell. Or Fennell. Or Fennell. I'm going to say Fennell. Emerald Fennell. Saltburn. I didn't know anything about it. My wife bought tickets to go watch it, and I went and watched it with her. And Saltburn has a talented cast. It looks fine as a movie. It looks like a movie. But does itself a disservice by having sort of corny visual moments that thinks looks cool, but has all the charm of like an antidepressant commercial. Okay, like there's scenes where you could tell when they were writing the fucking thing and shooting it, they were like, this is going to be so fucking cool. This is going to look really good in a trailer. Or decades from now when people are having retrospectives of my life. That's how I imagine Emerald Fennell's thinking. Years from now when I'm accepting a Lifetime Achievement Award and they show a montage of my work throughout the years, they're gonna show clips from Saltburn. You know, for example, here's the scene where I was just like you shot this because you thought it would look cool, but it doesn't really add anything to the movie besides padding, I guess. Okay. Okay, there's like a montage kind of scene where everyone, all the main characters were all like college age people. They're all wearing like ball gowns and tuxedos and black Ray-Bans. And they're like playing tennis and laughing carefree as the score swells. And it's, these people are supposed to be like hyper rich, by the way. I'm like, there's a fucking tennis court down the street from here. I'm like, tennis is not like impressive. Like, ooh, you have your own tennis court. It's like, it's not as cool as, say, an infinity pool or something. I don't know. I don't know why scenes like that were in it. I think it's just the writer-director wrote things down and thought, like, this will look really cool. And then made the thing on paper in real life. And it's sort of like, it comes off that way, like, this is gonna look so cool once we shoot it. And then, like, it's, you could tell they were going for a thing, but it was underwhelming. I also have a theory, like, nowadays, there's no reason for a movie to look bad. Okay, movies, if your movie looks bad, then it's just negligence, okay? And you should be arrested or something. But I mean, we have people have 4K cameras in their pockets. You know what I mean? Like, and there's no reason for a movie to visually look bad. And this movie doesn't look bad, you know. But it's like, I need more than visual candy to chew on. Like, I need a story to go with it. That's why people are, you know, that's why every once in a while, you know, you can look up a map of the United States and see, like, what kind of pornography are people watching in different parts? Red states, blue states, the Midwest, people live on the coast, poor areas, rich areas. What kind of porn do farmers watch? What about people who live in Manhattan? What kind of porn are they watch? You know what I mean? There's plenty of articles about, like, what kind of porn do people watch based on where they are. I don't even remember where I was going with that. Oh, yes. Now I remember. Movies, there's no reason for a movie to ever to look bad. Oh, yes. So you can watch porn, quote unquote porn. But people don't just want to watch porn. You have to have a very specific type of porn. Okay? People want a story. That's why people are really into, like, stepmom and stepson scenarios or, you know, things like that. People want a story. People don't want just lovemaking on camera. People are like, I need a story around it. Something. I need to be able to jump into the fantasy. I need to have an entry point. Okay, I need a story. And I feel like this movie, Saltburn, is lacking in story, but has all the visual bases covered. Has a great cast. But the story is just, oof. It's rough. It's really rough. Everyone makes comparisons to The Talented Mr. Ripley when they talk about Saltburn. But I prefer more of, like, Six Degrees of Separation meets the show Euphoria. That's really what this movie is going for. But isn't quite hitting the mark in either one of those two things. The Venn diagram of Six Degrees of Separation and Euphoria. Just linking together. Like, it's, like, I feel like that's what this movie was kind of going for, but it just didn't quite stick. It didn't take the way that maybe it was, you know, they hoped for. also comparing this movie to Six Degrees of Separation or Euphoria just, I think, gives it way too much credit. And I'm not even a fan of Euphoria, but the main character in this movie actually was in Euphoria, so there is that. And he was also in Priscilla. He's the guy who played Elvis, but anyways. This movie left me frequently asking why. Like, things would happen. I'm like, why is that happening? Why did this happen? Or what's the purpose of this, that, and the other thing? And some people attribute that to, like, oh, well, when you watch it a second time, it'll be better. And all those little why questions, you can kind of answer all of those and kind of fill out the story in your head upon a second watching. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to do that. I mean, there's plot holes in the story that I felt would be cleared up at the end, but weren't. There's a kind of quote unquote, a big reveal at the end, but it didn't offer any new or shocking information that we didn't already know, but was presented like it was some type of twist ending. But it really wasn't. Like, they're like, hey, this guy was doing this the whole time. You're like, yeah, we know. We knew that in the first 5 minutes of the movie. Like, I don't understand what you think. What? Where do you think the twist is? And in the end, Saltburn, it feels like the result of like an uncool person trying to write something that is cool, but doesn't realize that being cool is kind of like, it's like being book smart. You either are or you aren't book smart. And you either are or you're not cool. Okay? This movie had a lot of things going for it, but the story just wasn't there for me. There was too many questions that never got answered. And the answers that they did provide were questions that we already knew the answers to, if that makes sense. This is me trying not to spoil things. This is me trying to enter 2024, not spoiling every movie I review. So I hope you can appreciate that. So, that being said, I do not recommend Saltburn. You know, it had a lot of good things going. I love the cast. I thought it was shot cool. I thought the locations were cool. But all the pieces were there. All the pieces on the chessboard were there. The board was there. But the people playing didn't know how to play chess. They were playing Candyland or something. I would be interested in seeing director Emerald Fennell work with a sort of time-tested screenwriter so she can focus on directing the actors. You know, this is, she wrote and directed this, and I'm like, I could tell that she's talented, but I feel like if she paired up with a really good screenwriter, someone who can add depth and meat, put meat on the bones of the movie, I think that would be fantastic, because she's got everything else kind of working for her, but I don't know if writing is really going to be her thing. So I, you know, I'm not writing off the director. I'm just saying I would like to see her direct something that's like a that a really, really, you know, solid screenwriter can just make the story and she just directs the fucking thing. I would love to see something like that. All right. That's enough of Saltburn. No recommendation on Saltburn. All right. Let's do one more movie. Oh boy. The last film. And to close out the year of 2023, also saw in theaters, The Iron Claw. The Iron Claw, directed by Sean Durkin. It's the story of the Von Erich family. They're a family of professional wrestlers located in Dallas, Texas. And the patriarch of the family, Fritz Von Erich, was wrestling for years even before that. But really, it's about the family of the Von Erichs. So, okay, so for the uninitiated, before pro wrestling was sort of limited to WWE and now AEW, there were independently owned, regionally owned wrestling companies spread all over the U.S. Each of these companies ran their own wrestling shows. Each had a unique roster of wrestlers and champions. All of these companies were part of a larger organization called the National Wrestling Alliance, or the NWA. And the NWA champion, which would be from one of the territories, the NWA would basically choose a wrestler to be the champion. And the NWA champion would travel from territory to territory, facing off with all the top stars of each territory. Okay? So the territory would build up their stars, and whoever was the most popular, you know, the champ would roll into town one day, and then the local champ would fight the NWA champ. So pro wrestling was ran this way for a very long time, until a wrestling company based out of Connecticut called the World Wrestling Federation, whose owner, Vince McMahon Jr., began buying up territories and handpicking wrestling talent for the WWF, okay? Eventually, Vince McMahon bought up all the competition and basically had a monopoly on professional wrestling for a time. And the Von Erich family owned a company called World Class Championship Wrestling, the WCCW. And the owner was Fritz Von Erich, the patriarch of the Von Erich family. And he was by this point, especially at the point when we jump into the film, he's a retired wrestler himself, and he had a handful of sons, and all of them became professional wrestlers. And they were stars of World Class Championship Wrestling. And as the story goes, four of the Von Erich's sons died tragically. And all these guys were like under the age of like 30. Okay, like they were young guys. The eldest, Kevin Von Erich, who was played by Zac Efron, is the only brother who's still alive. So the Iron Claw is about that. It's basically about that family and about how the brothers, how they basically kind of along the way died. And there's sort of this idea that there was a curse put on to the Von Erich family, and this curse was killing off the sons of the Von Erich clan. Okay. And the movie kind of plays that up a little bit, but it's tragic. I mean, it's suicide. Accidents, overdoses, things like it's not like ghosts from wrestling past came back and were like killing all these guys. No, it was, you know, and they weren't like dying of like natural causes. You know, it was every death was a horrible, tragic thing. And it sort of we watch the movie sort of through the eyes of Zac Efron's character, Kevin Von Erich. So he's watching all of his brothers die over a period of time while still trying to help his father, you know, run this wrestling company, and him himself still trying to be a professional wrestler, and all the kind of drama and business behind the scenes crap that goes along with that. And by and large, I really like The Iron Claw. I thought it was a really well-made movie. It does have random clunky moments that are a little that are a little kind of cringy and weird, but those little things that I kind of didn't like, were, most moviegoers probably won't notice and will probably just think I'm nitpicking, but wrestling fans of that era would notice the things that I kind of notice. But it doesn't take away from how good the movie is. Okay, there were a few things in the movie where I'm just like, what the fuck is that about? But it doesn't take away from the movie as a whole. I think it's a very respectful look behind the kind of kayfabe world of old school wrestling. Okay, it really focuses on the family and sort of their sort of the pressure from their father to be sort of great athletes, but all of them end up becoming wrestlers one way or the other. Like the youngest son, he wants to be in a band and he's more musical, more artistic, but dad's like, no, you need to bulk up, son. We need to get you in the fucking ring. Like, and then, okay, well, there's Jeremy Allen White's character, you know, Carmi from The Bear. He plays the brother, Kerry Von Erich, who I grew up with, Kerry Von Erich. Okay. And Kerry Von Erich, it's like, well, one thing that, here's a nitpick. Jeremy Allen White's like 5'8", maybe. 5'7", 5'8", on a good day. You know, maybe 170, 80 pounds, maybe. You know, he did bulk up for the movie. You know, Kerry Von Erich was 250 pounds. He was 6'5", jacked, chiseled. So I was just like, Jeremy Allen White? It's kind of short. But he did a good job. He did a good job. And Kerry Von Erich died, I don't want to say in the most tragic way, but I remember my brother and I were big wrestling fans growing up, and we read, there was a magazine called Pro Wrestling Illustrated. There was a bunch of different wrestling magazines, but Pro Wrestling Illustrated was like the main magazine that you read. And it kept track of all of these wrestling territories, okay? Because the only wrestling you can watch on TV is WWF and WCW. And depending on where you lived, maybe you saw a local territory, show on cable. But if you wanted to know about all these other companies, you had to read the wrestling magazines. And I remember when they announced that Kerry Von Erich committed suicide. And it's in the movie, and I think it's handled very respectfully. You know, it's not gratuitous or gory or anything like that, but like the emotional punch of each of the deaths of each of the sons really is really like, it gets you. It's like, oh my God, it's terrible. It's just one tragedy after another, just, you know, hitting this family. And but you see the family really kind of keep their shit together. They're there for each other. They're very tight knit, and it's sort of this family kind of pushing against this, you know, lack of a better term, curse that's creeps up from time to time to, you know, take out a member of their family from time to time. And it's, the movie's really sad, but it's really good too. And it's got a nice mixture of, like, you know, it has moments that are really sweet and funny. And, you know, there's a lot of, like, guys wrestling in the ring type stuff. Like, all that stuff is very accurate to the time. Okay, I do have to point out one thing. There was a guy who played Ric Flair. Everybody knows Ric Flair. And I'm not the first person to bring this up. This is all over the internet. The guy who they got to play Ric Flair is terrible. Physically, his body works. Big guy, jacked, not too chiseled. You know, Ric Flair was never like the most like chiseled, jacked looking dude. But there's a scene where he's cutting this promo, this like pre-match interview, and it's so bad. It's so bad. Like, the guy they got to play him, I don't know how he got casted. I don't know if the director's his cousin. I don't know what happened there, but that, if you're not a Ric Flair fan, you know, it's like you might not notice this, but it's like, good Lord. The guy they got to play Ric Flair was absolutely terrible. But you know, who would have been a really good Ric Flair? Bradley Cooper. Bradley Cooper would have been a great Ric Flair. You sit Bradley down and you tell him, like, okay, we're going to start shooting this thing in about 9-10 months. So what we're going to do is we're going to get you on some steroids. We're going to get you on some testosterone, and we're going to get you up to like 240. We're going to bulk you up, and then we're going to grow your hair out. And then we're going to make it platinum blonde. Okay. And you're going to become the nature boy, Ric Flair. And I think Bradley Cooper would have been absolutely fantastic. But yeah, Bradley Cooper was too busy making Maestro, so he didn't have time for the Iron Claw. But that's, again, total nitpicks. You know, what I'm saying is, I recommend the Iron Claw. I liked it a lot. I hope it wins some awards. I will say I cried twice watching this movie. I teared up twice, and I never thought I'd see the day where I'd say Zac Efron made me cry, but he did. He's great in this movie. And I want to see more stuff like this. And there is stuff like this around, but I want to see, like, the subject matter taken seriously and people making these types of wrestling, the world of wrestling movies, because there's so many crazy stories. Was it director Todd Phillips was working on a Hulk Hogan biopic some time back. He was going to star Chris Hemsworth. Chris Hemsworth was bulking up to play Hulk Hogan. This was pre-COVID. But the project ended up getting dropped. I'm guessing it's because, you know, Todd Phillips, he did Joker. And off the success of Joker, he could have just made whatever he wanted to. And he wanted to make this Hulk Hogan movie. But I think maybe he was pressured. And by pressured, I think he was given a lot of money to make a sequel to Joker, which, from everything I've ever read, Todd Phillips was one and done. He was going to make one Joker movie and move on. He was not interested in contributing to, you know, the DCU, the DC cinematic universe. He was that no interest in that whatsoever. The Joker movie's not even connected to the, like, Zack Snyder Superman DC world. It's not even connected in any way. So he was like, I'll do one movie and then I'll just move on, and then I can make my Hulk Hogan movie. But I think they dangled enough money in front of him. He's like, sure, I can make another Joker movie. So we're going to get another Joker movie. It's going to be a musical. It's going to star Lady Gaga as Harley Quinn. I have mentioned on previous episodes, Todd Phillips, talented guy. But I mean, if you just look at his Hangover films, you know, he's kind of seen as a guy who makes sequels. He's made all the Hangover movies, but every Hangover movie, the more of him he made, they just got less and less successful in terms of money. So, but I'm sure he got paid a lot to make each one. So, you know, I really hope he revisits making the Hulk Hogan movie. I think that would be great. But with all the, I mean, there's like pro wrestling sort of series, like shows, you know, there's GLOW, the one that Marc Maron was in. And I thought GLOW was great. Dark Side of the Ring. Dark Side of the Ring is fantastic. Young Rock, which I've only seen a few minutes of Young Rock. It's not really, it doesn't look like it's my type of TV show, but it's basically like, here's the story of The Rock when he was a kid and when his dad was a wrestler. And even for a little farther back, there was like documentaries like Behind the Mat and Wrestling with Shadows. And there was The Wrestler, probably my favorite Darren Aronofsky film. That was a really good movie. And it's about a pro wrestler. So now we have The Iron Claw. So I hope more wrestling movies are on the horizon based on the success of The Iron Claw. And because the amount of fascinating stories in the world of wrestling from 70s, the 80s, the 90s, early 2000s, it's never ending. It's totally endless. The amount of characters and the lives that they led in this crazy company or this crazy industry, you know? Because pro wrestling is essentially like a circus, okay? You have these people performing this weird thing half naked 300 days out of the year. And it requires an amazing amount of like physicality and charisma. And you just do it all the time. There's no season for wrestling. It's all year for years and years and years until your body breaks down and then you just stop doing it. You know, and the show goes on. You know, wrestling doesn't get canceled. It just keeps going. You know, so it's like there's so much there to work with. So the more wrestling TV shows and movies, I think documentaries, I think the better. Let me go back to it. I highly recommend Dark Side of the Ring, and it's sort of a documentary style show about wild true stories from the world of wrestling, and it's got it all. It's got comedy, sex, drugs, violence, murder, tragedy. You know, it's got everything. It's a really good show. It was initially on Vice, but I know it's streaming on other platforms. So go find it. Find Dark Side of the Ring. And there's actually an episode, and I think it might be called The Curse of the Von Erichs, but it's about the Von Erich family. So if you've seen The Iron Claw and you liked it and you want to know a little bit more, go find Dark Side of the Ring, find the Von Erich episode, and there's a bunch of other stuff on there too. It's a really good show. But yeah, again, I recommend The Iron Claw. It's one of the few movies this year that actually, you know, made me feel anything. But I watch a bunch of other stuff too. I didn't feel like talking about it on this end of the year episode. You know, like I watched The Killer, the Netflix David Fincher film starring Michael Fassbender as an assassin killer guy. It's like the most boring David Fincher film, but it's still very entertaining. I thought it was fine. I don't really have much else to say about it. I thought it was fine. I probably won't rewatch it, but, you know, technically, I thought it was, you know, very well made, and, it, you know, the story was cool. It's very coherent. It's a simple revenge story. What else? There was, what the hell? Let me get the Mother God documentary. What is the full proper title? Love Has Won, The Cult of Mother God. That is a documentary. What did I see that on? I think it's on HBO or HBO Max or whatever the hell it's called nowadays. Yes, Love Has Won, The Cult of Mother God. If you're into cults and you like watching shit about cults, check this one out, because this isn't a cult from like the 80s or something. This is a cult that was around during COVID, okay? And it's fucking weird. It's like these group of weirdos who worship this one woman who apparently didn't consume anything besides booze and colloidal silver, and ultimately her own worshipers killed her, slash she kind of killed herself, you know. But everyone likes watching documentary about cults, just kooky people pissing their lives away, their money, their time, the relationships with their concerned families, wondering why they're in a fucking cult to begin with. Go check out Love Has Won, The Cult of Mother God. And other than that, I've just been watching older weird movies. But that's it for me, guys. It's been a fine year, and I'm really looking forward to 2024. If you want to get a hold of me on the social media, you can find me on Instagram at skeleton_factory. It's probably the best place to find me. If you have any questions or you want to recommend anything to me, or you need a recommendation of something to watch or whatever, that's the best place to get a hold of me. I'm also on X at SFPodcastATX, and I'm also on Patreon at patreon.com/skeleton factory. It's the best place to support the show, and there's also a bunch of free shows there as well. Well, guys, I will see you all in 2024. Have a very happy new year, and thanks again for listening to Skeleton Factory, the podcast that's rescuing your movie night one movie at a time. I am Adam, and I'll see you all in the next one.